Berlin. 13B. In English, it's 13B1. 13, Yud Gimel, Amud Bet. Yud Gimel, Amud Bet. Now, let's just review the last Mishnah that we had encountered, which was under Yud Gimel, Amud Aleph, 13A. Shechitat Oved Kochavim Nevela Umetam'a B'masa. The Shechita of a Gentile is Nevela Umetam'a B'masa, and it defiles through carrying. And we read that and we said, first of all, the Oved Kochavim was probably an introduction by the censor to change what was originally Goy, and what we are talking about here is the slaughter of a Gentile, is Nevela, and we know that all situations of Nevela, we looked at that last time, we saw that according to the Torah, a Nevela is Mitame B'masa, namely, it's not just contact that causes Tuma with the Nevela, but it is even lifting the Nevela. So they have the Nevela in a box, you lift the box, you still acquire Tuma from the Nevela. Okay? Then the Gemara first said, Nevela in Isur Hana'ala. In fact, the Mishnah is pointing out that as far as the Nevela is concerned, yes, it has, there are some limitations that come from the Nevela. Namely, you can't eat it, of course, and it is mitame b'masa. However, isur hana'ah lo. When the Gentile slaughters the animal, that animal doesn't become subject to the prohibition of deriving any benefit from it. Well, what was the case where you would become prohibited to derive any benefit from the animal? It would be if the animal was used for idolatry. If it were used for idolatry. Because the strictures on idolatry are very great. And in fact, if something is slaughtered or something is given for the sake of idolatry, a Jew is not allowed to have any benefit from that. So the very fact that our Mishnah did not say that you are not allowed to derive any benefit from it implies that you are allowed to derive benefit from it. If you are allowed to derive benefit from it, then we assume that the Gentile is not slaughtering for the sake of Avodah Zarah, for the sake of idolatry. Now that, perhaps, is a leap. And that was the subject of the Gemara. The Gemara really wonders about that. Okay, man tana amar Rabbi Chiyah, Rabbi Abba, Rabbi Yochanan, the loka Rabbi Eliyahu, the ikar Rabbi Eliyahu, hamar stam machshevet oved kochavim. Rabbi Eliezer says, the stam thought, any thoughts, you have to just assume, the assumption that we make about a Gentile, is that his thought is always la'avodat kochavim, for idolatry. So Rabbi Ami amar achikatani. This is what our Mishnah really means. Shechitat oved kochavim nevela. The shechita of a Gentile is a nevela. Had min, but the shechita of a min is avodat kochavim. That is idolatry itself. So that implied here, we're now beginning to flesh out something that was really not in the Mishnah. And that is that there is somebody called a Gentile, and there is somebody called a Min. And it's really not exactly clear what the Min means. Right? It's very important to realize that Min is used in different ways. There are really a few possibilities for the Min. The Min is somebody who is a dye-in-the-wool idolater, a heretic? No, I can't say a heretic, because a heretic implies that the person was a Jew. And the first possibility, what the Gemara is seems to be saying is that this is referring to a Gentile who is serious about idolatry. So we now know that there are perhaps two different kinds of Gentiles, and that when we are creating borders and we are seeing what the lines of closeness perhaps are between the Jew and the Gentile, we see that there are Stam Gentiles, regular Gentiles, and then there are Gentiles who are in need, who are somehow obsessed or focus on the heresy of idolatry. Okay? Although, frankly, I'm not sure that's what it means. I'm not sure that there's another possibility. It could mean that a min is a Jewish heretic. It could mean that a min is a Jewish heretic. And that would be very different, because maybe what we are seeing here is an effort to contrast the Stam Gentile, the assumptions that we make about Gentiles, with a much more dangerous option, which is the Jew, who is a danger to the community. The Jew who is here, in religious terms, theological terms, is classified as a heretic. Okay? Now, these could have been, by the way, a variety of different kinds of Jews. And again, I'm not sure what this means. I'm not sure whether this is referring to the Gentile or whether it's referring to the Jew. The commentators are assuming it refers to a Gentile. I'm not so sure. I'm really not so sure. Rashi will refer to the Gentile. I'm not so sure. Who are the potential people that we're talking about here? If they are Gentiles, surely as far as the Mishnah is concerned, we could be referring to Romans. Okay? Romans, there are different stripes of Romans. There are some Romans who are just, you know, regular. They have minhag avot dehem b'yedehem, which is what we'll see the Gemara is going to say shortly. They simply do what their ancestors did, and they're really not involved in this idolatry of pagan religion. Okay? They just do it because it's customary. There's a difference between doing things that are customary. I remember I was in Japan. When I was in Japan a few years ago, I met a very intelligent man. And he was explaining to me about Japanese religion, that essentially most Japanese are of two religions. This is what he said. I said, well, what are those? He said, well, there is the basic religion of Japan, which is Shinto. He says, if somebody is sick, you go to the Shinto temple. But then there is the higher religion, which is Zen, Zen Buddhism. You never go to the Zen the Zen, not a church, temple. You don't go to the Zen temple for really, you don't go to pray. You go to commune, but not to pray. If what we mean by praying is you want a result. Before you get married, you go to the Shinto temple, he told me. Go to the Shinto temple, because then you have to pray that you'll have a good wife, that you'll have a good business, that all of those things will work out. That's what Shinto is about. Zen is about the lofty stuff of nature. You feel it. It's inside. It's very intellectual. That's a different kind of religion. It's not two religions. Two religions. In the West, we tend to put it all in the same religion. We have just different varieties of such religion. So, could be that we are talking about the the true blue Gentiles, when we're talking about the Min, or let's think, well, who could they be? The pagans were one. But realize there are other people around. There are dualists. I'll get to Christians in a minute. There are dualists. Dualists are those who've been influenced by Zoroastrian religion. Some of those are called Gnostics. G-N-O-S-T-I-C. Gnostics existed throughout the entire Middle East at that particular period of time. And Gnostics were somewhat dualistic, we would say. There's a great book written on the Gnostic religion. Gnostic religion was a religion where there was a light and a darkness, and a constant fight between light and darkness. Now, there's a similar thing in pagan religion. There was Gnostic Christianity. There was a certain amount of Gnosticism gets into early Judaism. And it could be that the rabbis sensed the danger of Gnosticism. Gnosticism, for example, believed that there was some intermediary in the creation. Some intermediary in the creation, because creation was a fallen reality. Okay? Creation is a place where sin takes place. And the Gnostics frequently would believe that the good God could never have created a sinful place. So there must have been an intermediary between the good God who is pure and the other, whatever it was. When God says, for example, in the Torah, Na'aseh Adam b'tzalmenu ki demutenu, let us make man in our image according to our likeness, right? The Gnostics read that and they said, oh yeah, there was more than one. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. So obviously God was counseling with somebody else there. Right? That's some Jewish Gnosticism, as it were, to the extent that we have it. Now, therefore, we could be reading an attack on these proto-Gnostics, which are in fact making their way into Judaism. In the Masechet of Chagigah, which I'm reading now, because I'm going to give a siyum on Chagigah for the day before Pesach. I'm going to do my siyum on the Masechet of Chagigah. Chagigah is filled with the dangers of certain types of apostasy. That is the source of Arba Nichnasu Lepardes. Four people went into some sort of a mystical paradise. Or Pardes is an orchard. Four people went into the orchard. And only one came out whole. Okay, Rabbi Akiva came out whole. The rest of them were injured. One became a heretic. One lost his mind. Correct. And Lisha ben Abuya became a heretic.
No, Lisha ben Abuya became Acher.
Well, he became Acher because he became...
He went to the other side.
He went to the other side, correct.
The other side,
correct. So that's a heretic. That's what we call heretics.
Oh, yes.
He became a heretic. So Gnosticism was impinging on religious life in that period of time. So I'm speculating that it could mean that. Margaret mentions another possibility, which is certainly possible, and that is Christianity. When we are reading here comments on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries, we don't really know the impact of Christianity in those times, and scholars are working on that. We're always speculating the extent to which you will find in rabbinic literature, if not explicit, anti-Christian arguments, implicit anti-Christian arguments. The explicit ones are fairly simple to figure out. The implicit ones are much more difficult because you really don't know what was in the air and to what extent the rabbis felt threatened by early Christianity and felt the need to define things separate from Christianity. Christianity, of course, was several different things throughout the first few centuries. Remember, pre-Pauline Christianity was a form of Judaism. It's only Pauline Christianity that begins to reject the law. That becomes a big issue for Paul. Well, among the things that are in the law, remember, is kashrut. Right? Kashrut is a basic piece of the law. So it could be that we're somehow functioning in that environment. Okay? So all of that is perhaps wrapped up in min. Or, so that would mean that the min might be referring to a Jewish min. And what we are seeing here is an effort to discount, to say that the Jewish apostate, we must exclude that person from the community. And the way in which, interestingly enough, this is done is by saying that his shechita is the same as the shechita of a Gentile, but worse. Right? It's worse. A Gentile's shechita is bad. Right? No, it's not bad. It's not kosher. Right? It's not valid. The shechita of the apostate is not only not valid, but you can't derive any benefit from it, just like something that is offered to an idol. Okay? So whether the apostate was that bad or not, you see, that's the way the apostate is being treated.
I wonder whether in this world of late antiquity, when this was all taking place, whether the, it seemed to me that you had the pagans, the Christians, and the Jews all living together in close quarters with a tremendous amount of toleration. Okay, amongst the various groups. And I'm just wondering whether the rabbis referred to Gentiles with the same sense of otherness or pejorativeness, okay, you know, that we sometimes do. Well, was it a more tolerable place? For example, in one of the books I read, they talked about a church being constructed in 300 A.D. in Tiberias. And the big issue was, should they create this church in this middle of this Jewish community? And what would think the same thing is going on Wall Street right now with the mosque? Almost the same language. So I'm wondering, what's the take of the rabbis?
Well, all I'm saying to you is pay attention here. You're reading primary sources to answer your question. You will read a lot of people. A lot of people will tell you what they think you want to, you should hear. They have a view of antiquity that says either that antiquity was a very tolerant society or that antiquity is a very intolerant society. You're reading now primary sources. So I'm not drawing any conclusions yet. I think this is where we've got to draw those conclusions from. This is, we're not the first people to study this. But frankly, the art school people don't know what this is really about. If you read the art school commentary to this, they don't know what this is all talking about, because they really don't sense the historical reality of that time, which you do sense. You do know, we know from archaeology, the way in which people were interacting with each other. And so we have to just, in a way, guess a little bit at the way in which they were they felt it necessary to create fences in that environment.
In the discussion we read last week about, what I remember is the comment that there are no medium among the Gentiles, they just do it out of habit, because their parents did it, grandparents did it. But in that reference, it does not refer to the people he's referring to as the Ekohavim, he calls them Nachrim.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought the whole idea was that the whole discussion actually was based on discussions about Jewish converts versus behavior of a non-Jew. Non-Jews you don't really have to worry about. It's the Jew they're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's all possible.
He's a fanatic.
It's all possible. Let's just keep going here, because we haven't gotten up to what you're referring to now, just in the review of the material. But hold off a minute. Let's just try to move through this a little bit. No, hold on. Shchitat min la'avodat kochavim. The tenina lahad the tanu rabbanan. We have learned in our Mishnah what the rabbis taught elsewhere in a baraita. Shchitat min la'avodat kochavim. The shchita of a min. Now here, a min, I think clearly refers to a Jew. This is clearly a Jewish min, is treated as idolatry. Pito pat kuti. Because here, you're trying to exclude the person. The loaf that he bakes is considered to be a kuthian loaf. All of these are simply ways of restating that you are not allowed to touch anything that this person has produced. Yeno ye nesach, his wine, the wine that he makes, is treated like the wine of a libation. Sifarav sifrei kosmin, his books, namely the books that he writes. Now, realize you're in a pre-modern society where we're not talking about the books that he owns. People didn't own books. These are the books that he writes. Even if he writes the books, Sifrei Kosmin, they are considered to be the books of magicians. So even if they look like the same book that we are reading, same, he writes a a Torah. His Torah is puzzle. It's invalid. V'yesh omrim af banav mamzerim. There are those who say even his children are mamzerim. Even his children are mamzerim. That clinches that we're talking about a Jew, because only the child of a Jew could be a mamzer. The child of a Gentile can't be a mamzer unless the Gentile is cohabiting with the Jew. So that's clearly we're talking here about the separation of the Jewish heretic. Tanakama, the Tanakama, ishto lom'o. The Tanakama, the other point of view in the Baraita, which was not brought here, was that nobody's wife, that you don't have to worry about a man's wife consorting with other people, because it doesn't matter whether she's a heretic, he's a heretic, people just don't do that. Okay? That was the first Tana's view, where he disagreed that his children should be considered mamzerim. Okay? Now, we go on. Amamar shchitat obed kochavim levinav just repeats the Mishnah. V'nechosh shema minhu. So now the Gemara says, when the Mishnah says the shechita of a Gentile is a nevela, that is to say, it's only a nevela. It's only a nevela, okay? We don't have to treat it as if it was made for idolatry. It's only a nevela. The Gemara says, v'nechosh shema minhu. Shouldn't we be worried that that Gentile was a min? Okay? That Gentile was really, they were religious about their beliefs. Amar Rav Nachman or Rav Barabua, ein ninin bo'umot ovdei kochavim. So we read this amazing statement here. There are no mins, I'll just use the term as mins, there are no mins among the Gentiles. Now, that could mean either two things. Either it could mean that the Gentiles just don't take this all that seriously. They don't take their religion that seriously. And we don't have to worry about them. What we have to worry about are the Jews. They take it really seriously. The Jews who practice idolatry, Jews who are turncoats, are really a problem. The Gentiles, they're okay. They're all right. We don't have to worry about them. But it's really the Jews who turn a corner and observe the observances of the Gentiles, they're the real problems. Okay? Or maybe this min is referring to Christians. We don't care if the Christians convert, if the Gentiles convert to Christianity. But what are they? They're Gentiles. What we care about is when a Jew converts to Christianity. Maybe it's referring to that. Or anywhere in between. Anywhere in between. The danger here is that type of apostasy that's on the outside. We just don't worry about the Gentiles having those kinds of apostasy. They are what they are. It doesn't really hurt us. It doesn't affect us. But the real danger is the Jew who does these things. That's the real danger. Okay? That's what I see here. Now, this whole thing is restated. Ein minim bu'umot ovde kochavim, because the Marava says, ha'ka chazina de'ika. But we have seen that there are minim among the Gentiles. That is to say, that here they're using the term min, I think very clearly, to mean religious Gentiles, religious pagans. Right? There really are religious pagans. So how can you say there are no minim among the pagans? And the Gemara responds, Eina ein rov ovdei kochavim minim. Most pagans are not minim. Most pagans are not these kinds of pagans. Sorry, most Gentiles are not these religious pagans. Sarva laki hada Rabbi Chia bar Abba Amar Rabbi Yochanan. He holds, in accord with the teaching of Rabbi Chia bar Abba, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Here's the key thing, Nochrim, that's what you mentioned before. Nochrim, again, another term for Gentiles, literally means foreigners. Shebechutzala aret. Foreigners who live outside the land of Israel, lav ovdei kochavim hem, they are not idolaters. They are not idolaters. Elam min hagavoteihem bivdeihem, but rather they have the customs of their ancestors. They don't really believe. Now, it's a little hard to know what he's referring to here, too. If what we are saying is that outside of the land of Israel, the Gentiles are somehow less dangerous, and in the land of Israel they're more dangerous, that seems to me to be what he's implying. Well, of course, he lives outside the land of Israel. So it's not at all unusual that Jews who live among Gentiles say, well, they're not so bad. However, the ones over there are. Or, maybe, in the land of Israel, there was just a higher degree of intolerance. Because the land itself is a land that is connected with the Torah, the observance of the Torah. If you do not observe my Torah, the rain will not fall, the grass will not grow, and you will be cast out from the land. So it's really dangerous as far as the land of Israel goes. Less dangerous when you get to Babylonia. New York, it's hardly dangerous at all. I mean, as long as the Gentiles are reasonable. Okay? Just see that we finish this, and then I'll take your questions. Okay? And the other possibility, if you read the art scroll here, the art scroll quotes the Rashi, and what the art scroll says is that it's also, he happens to be talking about outside the land of Israel. But if it's true outside the land of Israel, of course it's true in the land of Israel. Now logically, I don't understand that at all. Why would he have said the outside the land of Israel? It seems to me that he is trying to make a difference between Israel and the land of Israel, Israel and outside of Israel. But the commentators interpret this to mean how much more so do we assume that the pagans in the land of Israel are also really not idolatrous? That seems contrary to what probably is being meant, but that's what the commentators are saying to this, and that's what the art scroll says. Okay, now we're up to where we were last time. Questions?
The Talmudic study that we study now was the background to Birkat Aminim, or Birkat Aminim was the background to this Talmudic study?
Okay. You mentioned Birkat Aminim. Let's talk about Birkat Aminim. Birkat Aminim is one of the blessings in the Shmona Esrei, in the Amida prayer. In the Amida prayer, get into the prayer. Now just bring us right into the center. This is of the daily Amida. It is, none of this is in the Sabbath Amida. Keep in mind that the Sabbath Amida, the central section of the Sabbath Amida is about the Sabbath. The central section of the daily Amida is a series of requests, of petitions. Okay? So, one of the petitions, Pekabe Shofar Gadol Lachirutenu, blow the great shofar for our freedom. Sameis Lekabetz Galuyotenu, lift up the banner to gather together our diaspora. And bring us together, gather us together from the four corners of the earth. Baruch Atah Hashem, blessed are you, Lord, Mikabetz Nivchei Amo Yisrael, who gathers together the dispersed of his people Israel. Next. Hashiva Shofetenu, cause to sit our judges. Kavarishona, as used to be the case, as was the case in the beginning. Yoatzenu kapatchila, and our advisors, as in the beginning, as at first. Haser mimenu yagon la'anacha, remove from us sorrow and woe. Umaloch aleinu ata Hashem lebatcha b'chesed rachamim, and reign over us, you Lord alone, with love and mercy. V'tzadkenu b'mishpat, and judge us righteously. Baruch atah Hashem, blessed are you, O Lord, melech ohev tzedakah u'mishpat, king who loves righteousness and judgment. Now comes the next one. This is what we're getting to. V'lamal shinim al tit'i tikva, to the slanderers give no hope. To the slanderers give no hope. V'chol arisha kareget oved, and to all evil, quickly destroy. And all of your enemies quickly cut off. The evil ones, uproot them quickly and break them, and crush them, and subdue them quickly in our days. That's pretty strong. You can tell that there's some dangerous enemies out there. Okay? Baruch Ata Hashem, blessed are you, Lord, Shover Oyevim Umachnia Zedim, who breaks the enemies and subdues the Zedim, those who want to create havoc. It's giving you sort of a loose translation. But remember the beginning here. The beginning was V'lamal Shinim Al Tehi Tikva. To those who slander, let there be no hope. The Chola Risha Karega Toved, and all evil destroy immediately. Now, I'm going to read you the same prayer in the Nusach, in the formulation of the prayers, as recited by the communities of the Middle East. Okay? These are Eidot HaMizrach, communities of the Middle East. They say the following. Laminim v'lamalshinim. To the minim, and to the malshinim, and to the slanderers, al tehi tikva medevino hope. The chol ha-zeidim karega yovedu, and all of the zeidim, get rid of immediately. The chol ha-evecha v'chol sonecha, all of your enemies and all those who hate you, mehera yekaretim, quickly cut them off. Umalchut ha-risha mehera ta'ker u'tshabert u'techalem v'tachmi'im b'mirav yamenu. The end is the same. Baruch Ata Hashem Shover Oyvim Umachnia Zedim. But the very first word there was Laminim. Laminim Valamalshinim. That's why we call this prayer the Birkat Haminim.
It used to be only Minim, and then they changed it to the Malshinim, and then the
This prayer has undergone changes depending upon where Jews were. Hold on. They're depending upon where Jews were. What was the danger? La Malshinim. Malshinim are those who slander Jews. Right? Those who bring to the Gentile authorities slanderous stories about the Jews and the danger of the Jewish community, that they are really a danger to live with, that they read to the Megillah of Esther. Okay? Haman HaRasha. Haman HaRasha says to Ahasuerus, he says, you got to beware of these people. They have different customs than we do. Right? Therefore, what do you have to do because they have different customs? Right? You don't send them to school. You have to kill them all. Right? That was the message of the Megillah of Esther. Kill them all. That was what Haman said. So here you see these different ways of talking about these people, and the minim are terribly dangerous, as the malshinim are terribly dangerous. And you see the different nuscha'ot, the different forms of the prayer, really reflect probably on the community and some changes that took place in the formulation of the prayers themselves. Yes?
When I translated this prayer, I translated Zedim as the arrogant.
That's okay, you can do that.
But if you translate it as the arrogant, okay, you come away with an entirely different meaning from the prayer from what you said.
Yeah, I don't think it means arrogant at all. Because it's much too strong to be dealing with arrogance. That's when the Jewish community became sort of Victorianized. That is to say, to assume that everything is about ethics.
Silverman kind of a thing. BDB says arrogant.
BDB is also in the same mindset. They're victorious. They're victorious. Right? Their concept of religion is one of proper behavior, not of killing other people. Not of killing other people, particularly killing Jews. Putting the Jewish community into danger of the death. Of death. My statement that I always say about The English these days really don't understand this, because in a way they think that they're in favor of the Jews, and they love Jews, and they're anti-Semites at the same time. I don't have to tell you this. You know the dimensions of this.
It don't mean you.
What?
It don't mean you.
Yeah, not my Jew, but the Jews. They're terrible people. They're just terrible people. Yes, I saw someone.
Mayor,
yes. Okay. Thank you for standing.
Back to the phrase "metam obe masa." Different discussion. You said that, if I got it right, that even if it's in a box, it's still tame, right? Metame.
Mm-hmm.
The vela. Am I right?
Correct.
So the fact that it's encased in a box, it doesn't make a difference.
Right.
I remembered what you said at the Monday morning, I think, after the minyan, about the tefillin.
Uh-huh.
And the thick tefillin, which ta'on gniza.
Right.
But you said that if the tefillin is in a case,
mm-hmm.
then they're isolated, mm-hmm. then the thick tefillin is not, you don't have to put it in a gniza, right?
Right.
So what's the difference between this is encased and this is encased? What makes a clear separation between Kodesh and Chol, between Tameh and Lotameh?
The laws of Tumah are their own laws.
Yeah, but if it's a case.
It doesn't matter.
No?
The laws of Tumah come from the words of the Torah. The Torah, I showed you last time. I don't want to go through it again now.
No.
But the words of the Torah give us the laws of Tum'ah. The fact that when you lift something, right, that is already in the Vela, that you can become Tameh from it, that we know because it says no say in the Torah. Bin nasa. So it's because of that. There's no reason to assume that you can abstract from that and take it to another area. Is only as far as the laws of Tumah are concerned.
Well,
okay.
The fact that something is encased, sealed completely.
No, it's not. Well,
escape or from inside.
That's true.
All
right. But there's just no connection between the two. They're two different subjects. Okay. Now I'm just looking at. I was wanted to look at the Nusach Sfard, which is sometimes a combination of the. Of the Ashkenazim and Sfard, it isn't. It's the same as what we say. No, it's not. Look at that. Here, this is Nusach Sfard. This is what is said by many of the Israeli Ashkenazim use Nusach Sfard, and a lot of the Hasidim use Nusach Sfard. It says the following. V'lamal shinim al tihi tikva, v'chol haminim karega yovedu. So it says, let the slanderers be without hope, and let the minim perish immediately. Right? That's when we're stronger about the minim. Okay? Not just the minim should be without hope, but they should perish 1, 2, 3. Yes?
From what you said about the editing of the censoring of the Talmud being done by Jewish converts, one might accuse Minim and Mal Shinim are the same people, slanderers who brought false rumors. Perhaps most likely.
Were the Minim. That's correct. That's why in the Nusach Ashkenaz that we have, it doesn't even use the word Minim. And rather, it's all rolled into La Mal Shinim Al Titikva. You don't need the word Minim. So I think that the assumption there in the Nusach Ashkenaz, which probably reflects European reality, it's a reflection of the reality of Europe, is that these slanderers were, of course, Minim. They were Jewish chunkers. Well, maybe. That's correct. That may be. That these guys then, they took it out, or it also could be, we don't have enough evidence to say. It could be that it was the result of the Christian censors, whether they be Jews or non-Jews, that Minim was understood to mean Christians. And therefore, they just lopped it out. They wanted to make sure that there were no negative references to Christianity in the Jewish press. So that could be why it was taken out. Okay? All right. Okay, so back to Marano. This is on the right side of 13b1. Amar Rav Yosef Bar Manyuni, Amar Rav Nachman, Ein Minim B'Umot Obdei Kochavim. He repeats this. There are no meaning among the pagan nations. Right? Or, as the Art Scroll summarizes it, that is, the law of a min does not apply to a Gentile min. In other words, from a legal perspective, the only one we're really concerned about here, the one we have to exclude, is the Jew, and not the Gentile. Right? Lamai, why? In what regard was this law said? Ilema lishchita. What respect of the law of the min does not apply to a Gentile min? Ilema lishchita. If he means to say this in regard to slaughtering, that is, what a Gentile min slaughters is not deemed to be an idolatrous sacrifice. How could that be? Hashta shchitat min di Yisrael amrat asira. It's almost circular, the Gemara. Gemara says, how could you say that? Because if a Jewish min shchita is asur, it's prohibited because it's idolatry, dovei kochavim by it. You mean to say the min of a real Gentile, a real idolater, that's okay? So, of course, the Gemara is going back and forth here. In fact, maybe it does mean that, but the Gemara can't tolerate the thought that it could mean that. Okay? Ella lamoridim. Now, Gemara brings up rather a bizarre situation, which I'll explain in a moment. He means rather to say, in regard to pushing him down. Now, lamoridim, pushing him down, is not a good translation. It means getting rid of a dangerous person, getting rid of somebody who's dangerous. Hashta di Yisrael Moridim, now that we can get rid of, namely put, we can lower a Jew into a hole in the ground to get rid of him, Dovdeko Chavim Mibaya, you mean to say, could there be any question as far as the Gentile goes? Now this is weird stuff. This is referring to the Gemara in Masechet Avodah Zarah. See 27a and b. So it doesn't say what I'm looking for. Okay, down the bottom of 26a and b. Tani Rabbi Abahu Kameda Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Abahu teaches before Rabbi Yochanan. Ha'odei kochavim v'ro'ei behema. Idolaters. Now this is the whole tractate that's on idolatry. Okay, this is Abu Dazara. Idolaters, v'ro'ei behema are shepherds of cows. I don't know what do you call shepherds?
Cowboys.
Okay, cowboys.
Herders.
Very good. Wait, no. Ro'e behema daka. No, it's behema daka. These are shepherds. Behema daka is a shepherd. There's a shepherd. Lo ma'alin v'lo moridin. If they fell into a pit, you don't take them up, but you don't drop them into the pit. All right? Now, that's a pretty strong statement. That is to say, you don't try to get rid of them. Well, what's wrong with them to begin with? We have Ovdei Kochavim. Ovdei Kochavim are obviously pagans. Right? It's got to be a fear of these pagans. But you're not allowed to kill the pagans. You can't kill the pagans. But if they're already going to be compromised, their security is compromised, you don't have to save them either. Okay? Obviously, there's a danger to these people. Because it wouldn't make sense otherwise. V'ro'ei behema daka, those are shepherds. What could be the problem with a shepherd?
Because the image of the shepherd is the image of Jesus Christ. And when you go throughout all the mosaic presentations throughout the whole basin of
Greece and Italy and Turkey, you see that whole image of, you don't see Jesus, you see the sheep, and then you see them being led.
It's a very interesting thought.
And it's a wonderful...
It's a very interesting thought, because Rabbi Yochanan... Rabbi Yochanan lived in Tiberias.
Yeah.
And work has been done on the Christians who were in Tiberias, and the extent to which Rabbi Yochanan had relations with Christians, and was, it's to be understood in some of his writing, that he was countering Christianity. Might be translated then as Christian priests, or Christian teachers, let's say, Christian teachers. Very interesting thought. My original take on it, the classical take, is very different. The classical take is the danger with these shepherds is what?
Slaughter.
Bestiality. That shepherd, yes, in throughout Masechet Avodah Zarah, there is, Avodah Zarah is yet to be studied, because nobody studies this material, except the people who don't understand it. One of the subjects in Masechet Avodah Zarah is homosexuality and bestiality. And it is assumed that all pagans are homosexuals, and all shepherds engage in bestiality. Now, I assume that these kinds of assumptions are based on experience. I mean, they're not without experience. They're based on reality. So here, the danger of the pagan is bestiality.
And those people were marginalized, and they couldn't live in society. And what does a shepherd live? A shepherd lives in the fields, comes back only episodically.
Sure.
So it makes sense that those people who could not be included...
Absolutely.
Are you defending them?
It's a social defense.
It's not a defense. It's just a realistic appraisal of why it could be the stereotype.
Correct.
And cows, but I had a question. Sheep, yes, cows.
Well, these are sheep.
Cows.
Because the Bema Dot cow is a sheep. Yeah, that was a mistake.
No.
Well, anything is possible, but what we're talking about is sheep. What we're talking about is sheep. In our society today, I mean, I can't testify to these things, but people tell me that there's all kinds of stuff like that on the internet. That, in fact, this is stuff that goes on. It goes on. For us, it's kind of beyond the pale. I mean, we don't even. Excuse me.
That's also the argument that's made by the right about why there shouldn't be gay marriage, because
which
the next thing would be marriage.
Oh, well, that's today
by people who are serving Congress.
Yes.
They say in the Hebrew Talmudim, okay. It says, "Katam shem gazlanim lepi shedarkam lirhot et habeimot bevdot zarim." Basically, they are thieves.
Yeah, well, that's another way to look at it.
But the phrase, "lo ma'alim
ve-lo moridim." Lo ma'alim ve-lo moridim means...
In modern literary, the one I grew up on, that phrase always meant, it doesn't make a difference. The lo ma'alim lo moridim, it makes no difference.
Correct.
Does it apply here?
Apparently not. This seems to be, if someone has fallen into a pit, right, what are you required to do? The assumption behind this is that these are all kinds of dangerous characters, but on the other hand, they're human beings, right? So they're human beings, so you can't, you know, some people you'd like to get rid of, but you can't get rid of them, right? But do you have to save them? That's the assumption. Okay? Now, all this leads to the next one. Malin v'lo moridim. So you... What does it say? Lo malin, right? Ein malin. Lo malin v'lo moridim. You don't lift them up and you don't put them down. Aval. Key thing, this is just, we're interested in this. This is just introductory to the next one. Aval. Haminim v'hamisurot, or misurot, I think it should mean Musrat. Musrat. Vahamumarim hayumaridim velo ma'alim. Alright, first I'll translate it literally and then we'll see what it says. But meaning, the ones we're talking about, these heretics, Vahamosrat. A moser, you know what a moser is?
People who gave Jews to the
enemy. People who would give Jews to the enemies. Yeah, the enemy would say, I'll give you $1,000 if you give me a Jew. Okay? So those are very low characters and very dangerous characters. So we're talking about minim, mosrot, and mumarim. A mumar, what's a mumar? Is a heretic. Is somebody who has, a mumar, somebody who is an apostate, who has converted out of Judaism. Okay? Hayu moridim, they would let them down, velo ma'alim, and not pick them up. Now that is to say, you could actually, if you found these people, you could take the law into your own hands, as it were. Obviously, the law wasn't there. There was no law. And you could defend yourself by taking the law into your own hands with these people. So, I wanted to read this to you just to make it clear that we're talking about something that is highly dangerous. These are very dangerous situations. The way in which this is put is in theological terms. I think the theology, as it were, of the person who is an apostate or so on, I don't believe that any of these things really reflect theological realities. They reflect rather the danger in which the Jewish community finds itself from time to time in a pagan environment. And what you are seeing here is a series of defensive moves in light of that. Some of which make their way into the liturgy, but you can even see the way in which the liturgy softens it. Now, if originally you read that Lamal Shini Malti Tikva, that it's a very strong statement about people who slander Jews, when you read it in the context of what I just read to you, you can see that it's a soft statement compared with a really strong statement of throwing somebody into a hole. Okay? So that you're really seeing here, it seems to me, the development, or you're seeing this happen over a period of time. It's not, in the Gemara itself, the Gemara is not really defined clearly by time, nor is the terminology defined. So the min may refer to the Gentile, the min may refer to the Jew. Both of them were seen as dangerous quantities. Probably the Jew more dangerous than the Gentile.
Right. What do we know about that? What's the historical perspective?
Jews wanted to curry favor with Gentiles, number one. And number two, there was money to be made.
Why would they need a Jew?
Oh, the Gentiles? The Gentiles would often want a Jew. They would take Jews into captivity to hold them for ransom.
Oh, gotcha.
Because the Jewish community would pay ransom. And therefore, it was a way that people made money.
Probably not.
The Talmud mostly deals with this as a ransom issue, and not a slavery issue.
And these people were Jews who would turn over the Jew for the money.
Yeah, that's why they were so dangerous, because they knew the Jewish ways. They knew the Jewish literature. They were learned. They were educated, and they were hard to pick out. Okay? So this is a theme. It's just a fascinating theme, just to keep in mind when you read Jewish literature from the Middle Ages right to modern times, writing even today. If you read the things that are coming out, let's say, the way in which the Jewish community deals with anti-Israel criticism. I use it in a very general sense, okay? You will see you know, there are waves of things that are allowable for Jews to say and things that are not allowable for Jews to say. Jews can overstep the line as a Jewish community, and then the community comes down, or pieces of the community come and clobber that part of the community that steps over the line. That's what's happening these days with J Street. The question is it reasonable talk, or is that beyond what's reasonable talk? And this goes on constantly in Jewish life, is to define, you know, what the borders are. But of course, there's another, the other border is the border between Jew and Gentile. Because that constantly also has to be redefined. And to what extent should Jews be separate from Gentiles, or to what extent are we not afraid of Jews having close relations with Gentiles?
I wonder why, theologically, okay, in Torah, okay, there's not much really said, it seems to me, about Gentiles and the interreaction of Jews and Gentiles, as it seems to be.
In the Torah itself?
Yeah, the Torah itself.
Well, the Torah itself, you do have some. Realize that you have repeated attacks on paganism, on the pagans. We will see reference to that shortly.
Not attacks on the pagans. The Torah basically says don't practice it. It doesn't say anything about them.
Oh, you do look in the Book of Numbers. See that the herb is okay.
Umbrella dropped.
It's just an umbrella, it's okay. Book of Numbers, we'll see reference to this just in a little bit, about the Baal Peor, the worship of Peor. The rabbis, the Torah is not very happy with it. Amar Rav Ukva Bar Chama, lekabel mehem korban. Oh, maybe there is a separation, a difference between the Jew and the pagan men as far as something else entirely goes. And that is the acceptability of their sacrifice. Look what the Gemara is going to say. D'tanya mikem. For it is taught in the Braita, when a man from among you brings an offering to Hashem. Mikem. When there is someone mikem from among you. Standard rabbinic procedure in the Talmud is when you see the phrase mikem from among you, rabbis always interpret that to mean there are some from among you that are acceptable, there are some from among you who are not acceptable. That's why the phrase from among you is put in there. Okay? So with that assumption, v'lo kolchem. In other words, some of these offerings that are brought mikem from you are okay, but not all of the things that come from Jews are okay. L'hotzi et ha-mumar. In order to exclude the apostate. So, in other words, our whole system here, where you can bring a neder, you can bring a vow offering, or you can bring a thanksgiving offering, is okay, except for a mumar. We exclude the apostate in the community. The Jew who has decided to believe in another God, his offering is not allowable on the altar. Mikem. Furthermore, mikem means from you. Vachem chilati. I have made a difference among you, v'lo ba'obdei kochavim, and not among Gentiles. It's an incredible law. That means, therefore, that Jews can discriminate against Jews when they bring offerings. However, the Gentile, we cannot discriminate against. So the Gentile who is a pagan is allowed to bring an offering to the temple, but the Jew who is a pagan is not allowed to bring an offering to the temple. Okay? Why?
No, what's the pagan bringing an offering to the temple?
Oh, because the pagan says, I believe in many gods.
Oh.
And I also believe in the Jewish God. You know, the Jews are good. I was with some Buddhists yesterday, and I said, your God is good, your God is good, my God is good, we're all good. That's why we should love each other.
There are many paths, up paths, we should
Somebody said that, didn't they? I heard that. Okay. The Tanya Rabbi Yehuda ben Betera. No, sorry. Mimai. Wait a second. What is it?
Mimai.
All right. From where do you learn that it's permitted for a Gentile to accept the Gentile min's offering? Dilma hachikamar. Perhaps what the Braita is saying is mi Yisrael mitzadike kabel, from Jews, accept offering only from righteous Jews. If we're saying that there are two kinds of Jews, well, accept the offering only from righteous Jews and not mirshei lo tekabel, and from wicked Jews don't accept them. Aval ba'odei kochavim, but from pagans, klalu klalo, you certainly shouldn't accept any offerings. So the Gemara is saying, what right do you have to say that pagans you can offer and Jews can't? Maybe certainly pagans can't. And the only difference is some Jews can, some Jews can't. But some pagans certainly can't. How would you ever get the idea that a pagan could bring an offering to the temple? Wait, come on. Lo sokadata tanya. There's another baraita. The other baraita says, ish. The Torah says, ish. Ish, ish. Here, where is the number 14? I think they give you the quote here. Look down number 14. Ish, ish mi Beit Yisrael. If any person among the Jewish community, uminager bi Yisrael, or someone who is a convert in Israel, asher yakriv korbano l'chol nidrehem or l'chol nidvotam, asher yakriv al Hashem l'olah, who will bring an offering of any of their vows or any of their free will offerings that they bring as an olah. So it starts out first by saying ish ish. It doesn't have to say ish ish. It should have just said ish. Any man. Any man. Now remember, ish can be anybody. But then it says, ish ish mi Beit Yisrael. Beit Yisrael is of the house of Israel. So a Jew. So why would you say ish ish? So the Gemara says, ish, if it were just said ish, it would mean a Jew. Ma Talmud amar ish ish. Why is the word repeated? Ish ish. Liravot et al dekochavim. In order to extend this idea to idolaters. Shehein nodrin unidarin udedavot bi Yisrael. That they can vow to give vow offerings and gift offerings just as Jews can. Now that's quite extraordinary, because that certainly isn't what the Torah says.
And how could ish ish mi Beit Yisrael mean ish ish? So
it can mean anything the rabbis want it to mean. So either they're making this up because they want it to mean that, or they simply have an old tradition that in fact the central place, the temple, is a place where offerings can be brought by all of humanity.
But they cannot make the shchita.
They can make the shchita. Somebody else makes the shchita, but their offering can be brought. So that the Talmud talks about the Roman emperor. The Roman emperor sends a sacrifice to the temple in Jerusalem. First of all, he wants to be a nice guy. Now, he's done a lot of terrible things, but he wants to be a nice guy. He's got to rule these people, the Jews. So he sends an offering to show that he really is, you know, wants to be an emperor who is friendly. So he sends the offering. They offer the offering of Titus on the altar. Okay. Anybody can bring an offering that's a free will offering. That's the basic idea. So here, it seems to me what you see is that you have, again, a question of boundaries. It's a question of boundaries. Ultimately, Judaism is a religion that has to set boundaries because it's a religion of a people. Okay? However, it is also a religion that's a universal, has a universal God at its center. And therefore, to some extent, the boundary cannot exclude completely the Gentile. The Gentile, in fact, is permitted to bring the offering that is a free will offering. Right? The one who is excluded, of course, is the Jew who is a pagan. The Jew who is dangerous is a problem. That person we exclude. But we do not exclude the Gentile as a problem because we figure the Gentiles are Gentile. Okay? Now, of all things, just one more general comment that I want to make, to turn it over to you. All of this discussion takes place within the general context of Shechita and Kashrut. And I think that that's not just chance. Because there probably is no other symbolic framework in Jewish life that defines borders as much as Kashrut. My friends are sociologists. From time to time, when they want to see what Jewish communities have a sense of their own self-consciousness, always examine Kashrut as the key issue. Extent to which... No, none of those things. Circumcision doesn't tell us anything. Passover Seder doesn't tell us anything. Kashrut tells us the extent to which Jews are defining themselves vis-a-vis their environments. In all of the arguments made in the modern literature, for example, in our conservative movement, if you see the two books which we have published, one book came out that was done by Rabbi Dresner. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Rabbi Dresner's book about Kashrut. Published a number of years ago, was republished and renewed in a way just all about 6-7 years ago after his death. It's probably the best pamphlet out on Kashrut. I have several copies upstairs. I give them out to people. Dresner's book on Kashrut makes two points. What is special about Kashrut? Kashrut introduces us to holiness. That is the purpose of Kashrut, number one. Number two, Kashrut defines Jewish identity. That's the way Dresner approaches it. Now, the synagogue then came out with a separate book done by Rabbi Bill Libo. Same idea. So that whereas in a classic book such as Maimonides, Kashrut is spoken of in terms of concern for the animal, trying to minimize the pain of the animal, in modern books, that's much less done. Maimonides, who reflects on the health values of Kashrut, modern books you will not find that, at least in the very sophisticated ones you won't, because people assume that Gentiles don't, these days, get much sicker than Jews do, from their eating at least, and that whatever was the problem has been figured out, so it's not that it's healthier. But these two issues, the issues of whatever we mean by holiness, and that's sort of abstruse, but the last issue is identity. The area of identity is Kashrut. That's why I think all of this stuff is happening. This need to define the boundaries as far as Shechita goes is utterly characteristic of the preservation of Jewish communal life. And it is the eating customs that really make that most conscious in the community. Now, Gail, you have
your... Yeah, just that in reading this, are we to infer today from not accepting an offering from a Jew who is not righteous that we shouldn't accept a gift from a Jew that is not righteous? You know, what comes to mind immediately is like Ivan Bosky, although Princeton wasn't, was the one that...
Well, I can tell you the Ivan Bosky story. I was involved in that. Bosky was the seminary. I don't know if you know, but Bosky gave a very large gift to the Jewish Theological Seminary to name the library. It was for a while the Bosky Library. And then one night, it was no longer the Bosky Library. It was the end of it. So this discussion...
Did they give back the money?
No, the seminary did.
They did? Of course they didn't.
I believe the seminary did give back the money. Don't hold me on it. I could be wrong.
They kept them.
He
paid a very small amount of money.
That could be. That could be. Could be.
So you remember
that could be. That could be. Could be. However, the point that you are raising is a point that we have to keep coming back to. It, again and again, we have to define in the community to what extent can the community find acceptable the rewards of those in that community who otherwise should be cast out of the community. But you can't cast people out of the community. You have to create, however, borders within the community to treat people somehow differently from the community. And we deal with this too frequently, unfortunately.
Is there a chance that the allowance of non-Jews to, let's say, give to the temple sacrifice, which could represent sort of like a hedging strategy. I imagine at the time there are competing religions, and just as now I see people who wear multiple chains, probably at a serious and real level there were people in power or people with resources who weren't sure which was the right god or religion, so they would give to what Jesus was doing, or what pagan Romans, they would give their money and they might make a sacrifice. But what if, just in case, that sacrifice was sincere and they were in the process of converting to Judaism? You wouldn't want to reject that name. Could that be useful?
Well, I would think that if that's what were going on, it would say it. It would say something about the need to be more than just the pagans. In a way, a little bit of that is said, but it's not said the way you said it. You said it more actively, you know, that you're thinking about converting. What we did read was that the pagans are really not pagans. They don't really care about what they're doing. They don't take it all that seriously. They're just doing what's customary. So, but that's different, I think, than what we were saying, right? That's saying just the pagans are not such religious apostates.
I guess it may be that non-Jews might go to the temple to kind of hedge their bets and get sacrifices, although the notion is somewhat surprising to me. So I was kind of wondering, maybe way off the track, whether this could have been something to appease the censors about Christians showing some apparent tolerance when really they thought that Christians would never do something like that, and it was really, everybody understood it to mean that the medium and anyone who's at all has those predilections, we don't want to have anything to do with, and you know what I mean?
Right. Well, I think that there's enough material in this Masechet and in Avodah Zarah to give us a sense of the reality of what they were talking about. And this is, first of all, much pre-censor. Censoring of the Talmud is a medieval phenomenon. It's a medieval Christian phenomenon. All this reflects the ancient world, which is, you're talking about 1,000 years before. So, 1,000 years before, and we have plenty of information about the pagan kings sending offerings, and obviously there was something that was done.
So I mean, if you were guesting somebody else's country, it was difficult to even make an offering to their house.
Probably. But it could very well have been. I mean, I can well imagine, given all the other things that we've read, that you wouldn't allow a pagan's offering to come to the temple. That's frankly what I would have suspected. I would have expected that. I would have thought that you wouldn't allow it. I find it surprising that it is allowed. So it means that there must have been a desire to be inclusive on that level, to be respectful of general customs. It must be. Even in that world, where obviously it was also, there were many other circumstances that were so dangerous that you had to set up the barriers. Yeah?
I agree. At first I thought, when you read that, this is crazy, this is ridiculous, but then I was thinking about our modern day version of people coming to synagogue and praying, and there's no rule against Gentiles coming to synagogue. They come all the time for a bar mitzvah or whatever it is for a special occasion, and they're welcome, and you know, we want to show them what we're doing, and if they want to sing along, we're fine with it, right? There's no...
Not so simple. It's your right and your, but you're not entitled. You're almost right. We deal with this all the time. We don't have a simple answer to that question. For example, in Oy Zarua, people will ask me. People generally assume that it's okay for Gentiles to come to the synagogue, which is true. Although not all rabbis in all Jewish denominations would say that. It is okay. The question is, how does a Gentile dress in the synagogue? Do they have to cover their heads? And that's an interesting question. You know, we've managed to convey the Jewish community, let's say, in the conservative movement, is pretty comfortable with the idea of asking Gentiles to cover their heads. I realize in the Reform community there is a fair degree of discomfort with asking Jews to cover their heads because it's not acceptable in the Gentile world. I remember not so many years, you know, within my lifetime, I remember going to Temple Emmanuel and being asked to remove my head covering.
Is that why? Because it's not acceptable to the Gentiles? That's why you shouldn't do it?
Well, I don't think it would be stated that way. It's simply not acceptable in the modern world.
That's why they don't.
Of course.
It's not acceptable. It's not
the way in the modern world you show respect. To the contrary. If you walk into a church, you take off your hat. You have to take your hat off. You walk into a civil place in modern society, you remove your hat rather than putting a hat on.
Yeah, but the priest in the church is still also keeper.
Well, I was in a church in another country, and I was thrown out of that church just a few years ago. I wouldn't remove my kippah, and the church people threw me out.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I got thrown out. This was in Prague.
Prague?
I was in Prague, and they threw me out of the church.
So there are Armenians in London.
I don't know that they were. I don't know whether they were Jews. Who had converted to Christian? I don't know for sure. Four questions, yes.
If we wouldn't lose the second temple, would Birkat HaMinim would be written?
If we wouldn't have lost the second temple?
If the temple would still stand.
You could say that for half the blessings, frankly, in the Amidah. Well, not only to bring us back to the land of Israel, we'd still all be back, maybe. So I think that total reality would be different. Total reality would be different. Because realize also that losing the temple means more than losing the temple.
I think it generates a big hate around.
It means losing the land.
No, they moved to the Caesar gave them to be in Yavne. I mean,
but there was no more sovereignty in the land. There's no more sovereignty in the land until 1948. Between the years 70 and 48, Jews had no sovereignty in any land, certainly not in the land of Israel. So I think that's the key thing that's associated with the destruction.
But I don't think
that
the religious people in Israel at that time cared about the sovereignty of the... They were religious. The land wasn't there.
I'm telling you that that is key. That is key. Issues. If you look at the Amidah, we had here Professor Reuven Hammer. We invited him 1 year, and he gave a lecture... the Shabbaton we did, Reuven Hammer said the following. He took the blessings in the middle of the Amidah and he showed that every single blessing can best be understood as a comment on the loss of Jewish sovereignty. That was his point. Every single one. Even Rifa'enu Hashem b'nei Rafe, where we say that, heal us and we will be healed. He pointed to the sources of that, where it's from in the book of Isaiah, and there it's used as a metaphor for the Jewish people's lack of sovereignty in the land of Israel. So he says, everything. It's not about healing. It's all about our being in the diaspora and the need to return from the diaspora.
Yeah, but most of the Orthodox Jews at that time didn't own the land. The farmer owned the land. So and the farmer were like us conservative compared to Orthodox. You know, they didn't see eye to eye in most cases.
All I can tell you is what's in the book. You know, I never talked to any of those people. I only know what the books say, and I can't speculate too much. Yes.
Well, I think the question of identity is so interesting. So, to live amongst the other, your sense of identity must be profound. And reinforced, obviously, embedded in this chapter, reinforced by behaviors that you cling to, but that it can't be a superficial attribution. And that maybe the other comes into the temple because propinquity can be seductive, whether it's among sheep or amongst Gentiles.
Right.
And that you have to be ever aware of that. And so then you bring him among you so that you can maintain your own identity and still differentiate you from them and not join them.
Right. It's very interesting. Very interesting. Final comment. Perhaps you saw today that there was appointed the new head of the Union of Reformed Judaism. Eric Yaffe is retiring, and they just appointed the rabbi, who was the rabbi of the Scarsdale.
Westchester Reform.
I think it's in Scarsdale.
Yes.
He was appointed the head of the union. So in reflecting on Rabbi Yaffe's term, and Eric is a friend of mine, and I had him on the radio program a while ago, and I said to Eric, what did you do for Reform Judaism? How is Reform Judaism different today than it was 20 years ago? So he talked about the same thing. It sounded like it was a real advertisement. We're participatory. We're against music that is performed. Instead, we are all for participation of men and women. And then he said, the Sabbath, for example. The Sabbath was a problem, and we believe in the importance of the renewal of Sabbath observance. So what does that mean? You know? Well, it doesn't necessarily have to mean the same thing that the Orthodox say it means. You know, so we were doing that. And so I said, well, how about kashrut? How about kashrut? Well, that's something that we also have to think about. He said. He was, at that point, he had intended to deliver that talk to the meeting of the union. This was about a year and a half ago. And he was going to, he was going to make a statement for the reintroducing the idea of kosher. And it never happened. That speech was never given. It was never given because it was beyond what was permissible. That level of separation was something that they wouldn't tolerate. So,
the funders of the problem, not the people at HUC, or the...
Not the students.
Right,
yes, definitely not the students. The students could handle it, but it was the lay people. The lay people could not handle it because it was laying down certain borders of separation between Jews and Gentile, which were considered to be impermissible, right, in the modern world. So I rest my case. I think that that's what this is all about. And these are issues that frankly never go away. They change some, but they never go away. He continues.
Well, always interesting to hear about.